Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, we're still here, and what do you call this? Well, we declare this Slave Entrepreneur Month. Slave Entrepreneurs, where we focus in on at least one person who was legally born a slave in what we now call the United States, and they became an entrepreneur, and in some cases, they became wealthy entrepreneurs. True to form, we're going to cover one. Another one today. Some days we get more than one. And that's not always planned, but we got one scheduled. As a matter of fact, the guy that we're going to talk about today, we wanted to feature him 2 weeks ago, but then we came up with the Think Like a Slave series. In any event, let's get to more motivation, and then we'll get to Slave Artesianomics.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come. We'll be right back.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. this is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening, because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
It's My House, It's My House TV, our channel, here on Blog Talk Radio. Today, well, all this month, February 2022, it's for us, it's most people celebrate Black History Month, or many people do not, I can't even say most. But we have a niche. We have two or three niches within that, and we feature Slave Entrepreneur Month. That's featuring people who started out life legally as slaves and started their own business, and some became wealthy entrepreneurs. Black Towns History Month, and then Slave Artisanomics Month. Okay, well, that's how we break it down in those three niches. Today, we're going to be talking about Horace King, and the title of our podcast today is Horace King, Bridge Builder, and then Slave Artisanomics, and then 0.10%. 0.10%. Percent have to deal with the black population, particularly during the slavery days. In what we now call the United States. So let's go to the person that we're going to feature today, Horace King. If you're online and you go to our Blog Talk scrolling marquee today, we have a picture of Horace King, and let's get to it. Horace King was an African-American, and all this stuff is on Wikipedia. Every day I'm going from Wikipedia. All right. Horace King was an African-American architect, engineer, and bridge builder. You know, in 2022, if I asked you, name somebody black who plays some type of sport, on a college level, high school level, pro level. The average run-of-the-mill person, not even in sports, can probably name, you know, two, maybe three names. Bare minimum one. Okay. Even if the player's not even active anymore. And if I, you know, ask the run-of-the-mill critical mass black person or white person or any color, name a black entertainer, and they're going to be able to name at least one. If they live on the North American continent. All right. But if I asked you, name a black person who built a bridge. Name one. I don't think we have many takers. But I could be wrong if you do know of one, besides the one we're going to talk about today, 619-768-2945. Anyway, Horace King was an African-American architect, engineer, and bridge builder. It's the bridge builder that caught my attention. King is considered the most respected bridge builder of the 19th century Deep South, constructing dozens of bridges in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. In 1807, King was born into slavery on a South Carolina plant. Which is located in Kershaw or Shershaw, it's spelled S-H-E-R-A-W, or Shiraw, you might pronounce it that way, Shiraw, spelled with a C, South Carolina. Okay, man, I'm impressed. This dude built bridges. Okay, let's get to it. Horace King, also known as Horace Godwin or Goodwin, G-O-D-W-I-N. Sunrise, September 8th, 1807. Sunset, May 28th, 1855. He was an African-American architect, engineer, and bridge builder. Once again, he caught my attention because here's a dude that he built bridges. All right, King is considered the most respected bridge builder of the 19th century in the Deep South construction. Dozens of bridges in Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi. In 1807, King was born into slavery in South Carolina on a South Carolina plantation. A slave trader sold him to a man who saw something special in Horace King. You know what I'm thinking? You know, the same thing goes, you know, with the NBA and the NFL and NBL. They trade players all the time. I'm looking at this was the same mindset, you know, 100, 200 years ago. Anyway, a slave trader sold him to a man who saw something special in Horace King. His owner, John Godwin, taught King to read and write, as well as how to build at time. When it was illegal to teach slaves. King worked hard, and despite bondage, racial prejudice, and a multitude of obstacles, King focused his life on working hard and being generally good and generally a good man. King built bridges. He built warehouses. He built houses, he built churches, and most importantly, he bridged the depths of racism. Ultimately, dignity, respect, and freedom were his rewards as he transcended the color lines inherent in the Old South of the 19th century. Horace King became a highly accomplished master builder, and he emerged from the Civil War as a legislator in the state of Alabama. Affectionately known as Horace the Bridge Builder, King and the Prince of he also was known as the Prince of Bridge Builders, and he served his community in many important civic capacities. Once again, we have a picture of this guy on our scrolling marquee on Blog Talk Radio. He was in the Alabama House of Representatives from 1868 to 1872. He was born in Chesterfield County, South Carolina. Let's get to his early career. Horace King, born in slavery in 1807. In the mid-20th century, biographer F.L. Terry described his complexion as showing more Indian blood than any other. Taught to read and write at an early age, he had become proficient. He had become a proficient carpenter and mechanic by his teenage years. And this is all during slavery time. Okay, records indicate that King spent his first 23 years near his birthplace and with his first introduction to bridge construction in 1824. In 1824, bridge architect Ethelton came to, Sherrill, South Carolina, to assist in the construction of the bridge over the PD River. While unknown whether King assisted in the construction of the bridge or its replacement span built in 1828, Towns Lettres Truss design used in both the PT bridges became a hallmark of King's future work. When King's master died around 1830, King was sold to John Goodwin, a contractor who also worked on the PD Bridge. King may have been related to one of the family of Goodwin's wife, Anne Wright. In 1832, Goodwin received a contract to construct a 560-foot bridge across the Chattahoochee River from Columbus, Georgia to Girard, Alabama, today, which is Phenix City. You know what? We got to make field trips to this place. I've been to Phenix City, Alabama, a handful of times. Initially, living in Columbus, he moved to Girard in 1833, taking King with him. The pair began many construction projects, including house building. They built Goodwin's first house, then King's. This was followed by many speculative ventures, housing ventures, and the two men completed nearly every early house in Girard. We got to make a field trip there too. The Columbus City Bridge was the first. You know what? I probably had seen some of this because Phoenix and Columbus, Georgia, Phoenix City, Alabama, and Columbus, Georgia is like, you know, you cross the river or the bridge and you're in one place or the other. The Columbus City Bridge was the first known to be built by King, who likely planned the construction of the bridge and managed slave laborers who built the span. Now, let's go, and this is all on Wikipedia, folks. His rise to prominence. Between the completion of the Columbus City Bridge in Georgia in 1833 and the early 1840s, King and Goodwin partnered on no fewer than still during slavery. This man's in the partnership, which is another reason why I do not watch slave movies. I know y'all hear me saying this every day. Why I do not watch slave movies out of Hollywood. In any event, King and Goodwin partnered with no fewer than 8 major construction projects throughout the South. The partners constructed some 40 cotton warehouses. See, why don't they tell that part of the story? I guess it's up to us to tell that part of the story. Instead of us just cotton picking, show us designing, making the blueprints, you know, doing the architect work on making cotton warehouses. Which reminds me, include an Emmett Till piece on this. We might do that tomorrow. The connection between Emmett Till and cotton warehouses built by people like Horace. There's a connection there. All right, anyway, let's see. The partners constructed some 40 cotton warehouses in Apicola, Florida. I got to find out where that, matter of fact, where that is. I'm in Florida. That's in the Florida Panhandle. Okay, I see it on the map. Let's see. Okay, in 1834, scholars believe that Godwin sent King in the mid-1830s to study at Oberlin College in Ohio, the first college in the United States to admit African-American students. The two men designed and built courthouses of Muskogee County, Georgia, and Russell County in Alabama. From 1839 to 1841, the bridges of West Point, Georgia, and Eufaula, Alabama, and Florence, Georgia in 1840. They built a replacement bridge for the Columbus City Bridge between Columbus and Girard in 1841, as the original had been destroyed in 1838 by a flood. During a time of financial difficulty in 1837, Godwin transferred ownership of King. Now here's an MBA trade. That's what we would call it today. To his wife and her uncle, William Carney Wright of Montgomery, Alabama. This may have been done to protect King from being taken and sold by Goodwin's creditors. All right. So he was a valuable piece of property there. All right. Just like they look at LeBron James, he's a valuable piece of property with the Los Angeles Lakers. Y'all don't get bent out of shape when people say that, so don't get bent out of shape when I'm reading this from Wikipedia. King was allowed to marry Florence Gould Thomas, a free woman of color, in 1839. It was extremely uncommon for slave owners to allow such marriages, but the man was basically, Horace King was a capitalist. Point blank. And that's, when I hear black folks say, you know, this country wasn't designed for black folks. It was designed for capitalists. Here it is. I'm reading this. This is not my words. This is on Wikipedia. You can read along with me. Here is a man that legally is a slave. But if he played the role of a capitalist, he was granted certain privileges, and eventually he got his freedom. Now, this is all happening. Abraham Lincoln is nowhere on the scene. There's no emancipation, no talk of it. All right, anyway. Already married in 1839. It was extremely uncommon for slave owners to allow such marriages, since Francis's free status meant that their children would be all born free. Capitalism looks the other way. You know what? Capitalism makes a lot of people look the other way and alter their belief systems. Slave states incorporated the principle of partus secretum. I can't pronounce it. I had to work on that. What do you call it? Latin. Into the law since the colonial period, which said that children took social status of their mother, whether slave or free. You know what? This is estate planning. They were estate planning back then. In 1840, Horace King was being publicly acknowledged as being a coal builder. Now, this is 1840. He was publicly, in plain sight, recognized as a coal builder along with Godwin, an uncommon honor for a slave. King's prominence eclipsed that of his master in the early 1840s. He worked independently as an architect and superintendent of major brick projects in Columbus, Mississippi in 1843 and Wetumpka, Alabama in 1844. While working on the Eufaula Bridge, King met Tuscaloosa attorney and entrepreneur Robert Jemison, Jr., who soon began using King on a number of different projects in Loudoun County, Mississippi, including a 420-foot Columbus, Mississippi bridge. Jemison would remain King's friend and, look at this, their friends, Ebony and Ivory. We remain friends and associate for the rest of his life. Kingbridge, the Tallulah River and the Tallahassee, Alabama, in 1845. Later that same year, he built three small bridges for Jemison near Steens, Mississippi, where the latter owned several mills. Next section of, and we're talking about Horace King, bridge builder, and he was a slave artisan. For people who don't know what an artisan is, artisans are people who make things. One of the things that he made, and he did it real well, was he made bridges. He also made cotton warehouses for other uses, houses. Once again, his picture is in our scrolling marquee on Blog Talk Radio. Let's get to the next section here. Once again, all this is on Wikipedia. I every day I've been going with it. Despite his enslavement, King was allowed to keep a significant income for his work. Let's put there's a period on that. For all you ADOS people, for all you reparations people, for all you people that said that black slaves didn't get paid for doing work. Well, once again, let me read it again. All right. Despite his enslavement, King was allowed to keep a significant income for his work. He didn't build all those bridges and houses and cotton warehouses for free. He was paid. In 1846, he used some of his earnings to purchase his freedom from Godwin. And many slaves did that. They purchased their freedom. Well, how did they get the money? They worked for it. Once again, this is in L.A.'s words. I go from Wikipedia every day. And in the future, we're going to be making, you know, once things clear, because we haven't done a road trip in a while, we're going to be making road trips to some of these places and reading documentation and talking to the locals and going to some of the local libraries so we can get information that hasn't hit online on the Internet. Okay. So in 1846, he used he didn't have to use all of his earnings. He used some of his earnings. The man was living at a surplus. To purchase his freedom from the Godwin family, or the Goodwin family, and right. But under Alabama law at the time, a freed slave was allowed to remain in the state only for a year after manumission. Jemison, who served in the Alabama State Senate, arranged for the state legislator to pass a special law giving King his freedom and exempting him from the manumission law. 1852, King used his freedom to purchase land near his former master. That's why I went through all last week, think like a slave. People like this, and this is what I mean by think like a slave. There's always a way. Every problem has multiple solutions till you find a solution. That's what I meant by think like a slave, that whole series that we did last week. We probably would do a handful more before the end of the month. All right. In 1852, King used his freedom to purchase land near his former master. When Goodwin died in 1859, King had a monument erected over his grave. In 1849, Alabama State Capitol burned, and King was hot. Now, listen to this now. In 1849, Alabama State Capitol burned, and King was hired to construct the framework of the new Capitol building, as well as design and build of twin spiral entry staircases. A picture of this on Wikipedia. King used his knowledge of bridge building to cantilever the stairs' support beams so that the staircase appeared to float without any central support. In 1855, King formed a partnership with two other men to construct a bridge known as Moore's Bridge over the Chattahoochee River between Newland and Carrollton, Georgia, near Whitesburg. Instead of collecting a fee for his work, King took stock near its stock instead, gaining one-third interest on the bridge. See, that's real reparations. That's real reparations. Now, any of you ADOS people, you're not going to get that. Once he didn't get that from the federal government. He didn't get that from the state government. He got that from his skill set as an artisan. That's what I call real reparations. All right, now, instead of collecting this fee, well, I'll read that again. Instead of collecting this fee for the work, see, a lot of y'all, you give me this, reparations, just cut a check. He was smart enough not to take the check. King took stock instead, gaining one-third interest in the bridge. Abraham Lincoln is not on the scene yet. And he got his reparations. See, matter of fact, you know what? I got to bring out the calculator here. Stuff like this, this is why I'm not, now this is just me personally. Not judging, if reparations is your thing, great. But, all right, it's 2022 right now. All right, now. This transaction took place in 1855. That's 167 years ago. So when I hear about people and they, on Clubhouse, on radio stations, on podcasts, practically every day of the week, there's you can find a discussion about reparations. But the way I'm looking at it, particularly from a Horace King point of view, you're 167 years too late. My question is, do you have 167 more years to go? I'm just saying, King got what, in my opinion, was part of his reparations in 1855 when he, instead of taking a check, he took stock in one-third interest in the bridge. That's real generational wealth. All right, gaining one-third interest in the bridge, King moved his wife and children to the area near the bridge in 1858. Now, can you imagine the son? You know, he took his kids, wife and kids, and say, look, here's your, you're going to get an income from this bridge when I'm gone. That's thinking. That's, once again, real reparations. All right, although he continued to commute between it and their other home in Alabama, the man had at least two houses, no doubt that he built both of them, and no doubt he never had a mortgage on none of them. He didn't go to some government program for a down payment. He built it. And probably more than likely he taught his kids how to build. All right. The earnings from Moore's Bridge generated a steady income for King and his family. I'm done. You know what? I got to process this. This is pre-1863. 167 years ahead of all reparations talks today. Here's a man in 1855 who refused to get paid for the bridge, building the bridge, and said instead, you know what, give me the stock. And the bridge bought in, as I just read it on Wikipedia, these are not my words, bought in a stable income for him and his family. Think like a, that's what I mean by think like a slave. Think outside of the box. Don't let obstacles tear you down. The man built social capital. He was a capitalist himself. That's how he got a... He... What? You know what? I'm done. I'm not going nowhere, but I gotta tell you. I gotta process this. He's under the topic of slave artisanomics. Let's pick up. I had to take a 2-minute interlude there because this is just this dude. And the thing is, he wasn't the only person like this. He wasn't an outlier. That's why I put in the title here is 0.10%. We're going to go through what that means in relationship to him and other slave entrepreneurs that really became wealthy. All right. Now, he continued to design and construct major bridge projects through the remainder of the 1860s. It ain't 1863 yet. All right. And now, let's just call a spade before. This man was wealthy. He and his family had two homes, debt-free, that he built. And he was getting income from one of the bridges that he built. He probably built other bridges. But this one, he didn't get paid. He's no. I want stock. Don't give me a check. Just give me the stock. All right. So his family continued to earn money from the bridge, Moore's Bridge, to be exact. Moore's Bridge generated a steady income from King and his family. He also continued to design and construct major bridge projects through the remainder of the 1850s, including a major bridge in Mildred, Georgia, and a second at the Chattahoochee Crossing in Columbus. Now, let's go to another aspect of his life. We're talking about Horace King. You can read about him on Wikipedia. I do it every day. And there's a picture of him on Wikipedia, and we have him in our scrolling marquee here on Blog Talk Radio. As a slaveholder, in the 1850s in Columbus, Georgia, King, now here's a guy who started out life as a slave himself. Then he became wealthy as a slave. All right. King purchased a slave who eventually became known as celebrated abolitionist J. Stella Martin. When King attempted to subdue Martin by flogging him, he was disappointed by the man's resistance. He quickly sold Martin to a slave trader. All right. And we can call that a bit of a blemish. Now, let's go and let's read about J. Stella Martin. J. Stella Martin. John Stella Martin, 1827 to 1832 to August 11, 1876, escaped slavery in Alabama and became an influential abolitionist and pastor in Boston, Massachusetts. He was an activist for equality before the American Civil War and traveled to England to lecture against slavery. When he returned, he preached at a Presbyterian church in Washington, D.C. Okay, now, let's get to his early years. All right, John Stella Martin was born into slavery in 1832 in Charlotte, North Carolina. His mother was a slave. His father was a white master. Let's see. Okay, at the age of 6, Martin and his mother and his only sister were taken to Columbus, Georgia, where they were sold. His mother and sister were purchased by one man, and John Stella Martin purchased by one free black man named Horace King. He knew the owner. His new owner was an old bachelor. Martin served him in the capacity of valet at age 18. They resided together in one of the principal hotels in Columbus, and Martin was given the opportunity to learn how to read and write, as well as exposed to more worldly glory. False freedom. When Martin was 16, his owner went blind, and Martin was entrusted with helping him carry out his personal affairs. He gave the youth a home school type education. When the master died, Martin, then 18, was set free by his will. This is after King sold him now. Okay. After escaping slavery in Alabama in 1856, at age of 24, Martin made his way north by reaching Canada. He finally settled in Boston, Massachusetts, considered the center of freedom for blacks. It had a strong biracial abolitionist movement. In 1859, he gave an eloquent narrative. Hold, let me see. Okay, we're going to come back to him because there's quite a bit on J. Sella Martin. Okay. Anything else we can find here? So, all right, let's go by my program notes here. And also on Wikipedia, let me go through before on Horace King, some of his works. He built bridge in Columbus, Georgia. He built at least 40 cotton warehouses. He built the bridge in West Point, Georgia, Ephelia, Alabama, Florence, Georgia. He did a replacement bridge in Columbus, Georgia. He built the courthouse in Muskogee County, Alabama. Russell County also. He did the Red Oak Covered Bridge in Georgia. He did a second bridge in Columbus, Mississippi, after the bridge burned down. The Winnetumpka, Alabama Bridge in 1844. The Tallahassee, Alabama Bridge in 1845. He built three minor bridges in Steens, Mississippi in 1845. He did interior framework and spiral staircases at the Alabama State Capitol in Montgomery, Alabama. He's listed on the National Register of Historical Places, that building is, as well as the National Historic Landmark. He built Moore's Bridge, that's where he got an income off of, in Whitesburg, Alabama. Let's see, the Millbridge, Georgia Bridge in the 1850s. Okay. Now, that's what we have on for today. Horace King, bridge builder, house builder, warehouse builder. If I had the song in the queue, I'd play it in honor of him. He was a bad mamma jamma. Now, we have the program notes here. Horace King, he demonstrated slave innovation. You can say, the building trades, he was a master of that. But let's go, I want you guys to take a look at the slave population. Oh, and here goes back to our title. I have in our title, Horace King Bridge Builder, and that guy I have in parentheses, 0.10%. So we're going to get into what that means now, because Horace King was part of that 0.10%. The slave population in 1860 was 3,953,742 or 3,952,838. Take your pick at which one. They're about the same. All right. Now, the Maryland slave population in 1850 was 87,189, about 12.7% of the population. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is part of our headline today, Slave Artisanomics, that out of that figure of 87,169 people, there was a small group of that people that said, you know what, let's go back to Africa. They organized a group of people Because, see, and here's one of the things that, particularly when it comes to reparations and all this stuff, people, on a critical mass basis, some black folk on a critical mass basis believe that, at least they talk this way, that we're a monolith. But we look, white folks are not a monolith. So in the 1850s, talk of, let's go back to Africa. But the majority of black slaves that became free said, no, no, no. I was born here in Maryland. I was born here in the colonies. I was born here in the States. I ain't going nowhere. Which is fine. But there were a group of black folks that got together out of that 87,000. Trust me, that's why I put that 0.10%. That's less than 1%. So you know what? We got the money. We got the wealth. We got the ambition. We know how to build the town. We know how to, we got furniture. We're artisans. Let's practice artisanomics. So they made the furniture. They made the brooms. They built the ships. They built what they needed to build to get the financing together to make that voyage over to Africa and buy land. Upwards to over 2.5 million acres of it. And they started the Republic of Maryland. That's on Wikipedia. We covered that 2 weeks ago. Read it for yourself. The Republic of Maryland existed as a recognized state, its own sovereign nation, for, I believe, 23 years. Something like that. 22 to 23 years. Read about it. Put in any search engine, Republic of Maryland. Now, it no longer exists under that name. You look it up, you'll see what happened. But they do exist under the name as Maryland County, Liberia. It exists to this day. And that was started by slave artisans practicing artisanomics, which is nothing but cooperative economics. Everybody's not going to, the majority, you know what, 80 to 90% of the people are not going to sign up. They're not going to, but that's all right. The next figure I want to throw at you, I haven't finished with the, out of the 3.9 million free people, okay, 0.10% of that, you're going to get roughly about 4,000 people. So you had at least 4,000 black folk that were slave owners. That's a lot of people. No, it's not everybody, and it's never going to be everybody. White folks don't have everybody, since we're going by white folks standards so damn much, they don't have it all together. The Soviet Union didn't work out. That was mostly white folks. It didn't work out. You got different people, different cultures, speak different languages. Look, on planet Earth, there's about 5,000 to 6,000 living languages on planet Earth. There's a culture attached to each and every one of those. Everybody is not going to be on the same page if the system's not set up that way. So stop thinking and stop saying if only black people can get, they're not going to get together because nobody can get together on a mass level. That's what the 0.10% represents. And that's the slaveholders. And in Louisiana, there were over 10,000 black folks that were free. 10,000 right there. But for some of you, I guess if you didn't see it in a movie coming from Hollywood, you're stuck. All right, another statistic here. The Mississippi population, slave population, in 1830s went from 65,659 to 195,211. Now, the reason why I brought up that statistic, and I got these statistics online just like you can, you can fact check me, is that Mississippi at one time had the largest number of slaves, as well as free slaves. So a small group of those people, 300 to be exact. Now, I'm going to take, once again, in the 1830s, let's go to 1830, there were 65,659 black folk, combination of freed slaves and enslaved people. And then later in the 1830s, by 1840, there were 195,211 blacks, the largest in the nation at that time. You had slave entrepreneurs. You had artisans, wealthy black artisans in the state at that time. And somebody got the idea, you know what, let's go back to Africa. This didn't happen in the state of Maryland, but the Republic of Maryland. And now you can take either figure, 65,000 or 195,000. But out of thousands of black folk could have gone back to Africa, there were only 300 of them that said, you know what, we're going to do this. And a total of 300 black folk, through artisanomics, a.k.a. slave economics, slave innovation, 300 of them, which was the largest of any successful Back to Africa organization on the planet to this date, coming out of North America. But there are no slaves now, so the day don't count. 300 of them had the resources to charter boats, or they probably built them, to be honest about it. They made their way to Africa, and this is just one. This is what I want to put together with you guys. They built, and you can look this up online, look up Greenville, Liberia. Greenville, Liberia was started by this group of people that were slave artisans, practicing slave artisanomics. Greenville, Liberia. Now, the reason why this is so significant, and this is one place I've been to. I've been to Greenville, Liberia yet, but I've been to Greenville, Mississippi. That's where my stepfather was from. The first outhouse I used, it was a Christmas vacation that we took we drove from D.C. down to Greenville, Mississippi. It was named after, if they named it after Greenville, Mississippi, I'm assuming you had a substantial amount of people from Greenville, Mississippi that made that voyage to Africa. So you got people in 2022 that were born in Liberia, Africa, on the continent of Africa, that they can trace their roots back to Greenville, Mississippi today. So good luck, those people. good luck to, unless you got a group of any of those people that say, you know what, we're not a monolith, we're never going to be a monolith. And what these people did, oh, look up, it's called Mississippi, if you want to fact check me now, fact check me. Look up on Wikipedia, online, type into any search engine, Mississippi in Africa. Mississippi in Africa, type it into a search engine and get the rest of the story, and then type in Greenville, Liberia. I don't care about the, this is just like the when the Hebrews or the Israelites left Egypt, you know, and they were cussing Moses out, and we weren't starving in Egypt and wanting to run back to the government. That's what Pharaoh represents. Being dependent upon government. But those who crossed that Red Sea, promised land and freedom. Now, freedom cost. But once again, look it up online. Greenville, matter of fact, look up Greenville, Mississippi, Greenville, Liberia, and Mississippi in Africa. And then also look up Republic of Maryland. I consider, now this is just me, I consider the black folk, the former slaves that became capitalists, who bought their freedom, who bought their relatives' freedoms or friends' freedoms, who used their artisanomic skills as slave entrepreneurs and built boats and built cotton warehouses and built plantations and just built everything you can think of. To me, that's real reparations. Horace King, building that bridge and not going for the okey-doke check, which is just one paycheck. He went for the residual income for himself and his family. That's real reparations in my book. None of these, now, when you read it yourself, Republic of Maryland, Greenville, Liberia, matter of fact, let's go to something real quick. Greenville. And I'm coming to the phones. Greenville, okay, yeah. Greenville, Liberia, which today has a population of 16,443 people. And some of them can trace their descendants all the way back to Greenville, Mississippi. Okay. And one statistic I have not been able to find yet is how much land they purchased to establish that township. And that's why we call this, we have Black Towns History Month, because here's a black township. I typically, when I talk about black townships, they've been typically here in the United States. I did feature one that was in Colombia in South America. Greenville, I also deem this on It's My House Black Towns History Month, because Greenville, Liberia was a black town built by African, well, what we would call African Americans these days, or what do you call it, Americos over there now, they built something based on in honor of their hometown of Greenville, Mississippi. All right, I'm coming to the phones here soon. Now, for me, this is just me personally. That's why I do not buy into the specter, and I consider the specter, you don't have to, the specter of white supremacy. I don't buy into it. Because if Horace King and these other people can do what they did back then, I have no excuses now. Once again, I'm just speaking for myself individually. We're going to play this little clip, and we'll be back to take phone calls right after this.
I say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. Couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars he is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back out the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Woo. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
All right. Now, before I go to the phone lines here, let me give a little bit more about Greenville, Liberia. Greenville, Liberia is the capital of Sonoma County in southeastern Liberia and lies on a lagoon near the Sonoma River and the Atlantic Ocean. It is located about 150 miles southeast of Monrovia, and as of 2008, National Census, the population stood at 16,434 people. Okay, let's see. Once again, we're still on Greenville City, Liberia. The town was built about 1838 by colonists of the Mississippi Colonization Society, part of which was then the Mississippi in Africa Colony. Greenville was named after Judge James Green, one of the first Mississippi Delta planters to send a group of former slaves to Liberia. The town was destroyed by the in the Liberian Civil War. And what year was that? That was 1819. All right, that's not new people did that. All right. The town was destroyed by in the Liberian Civil War, but has since been rebuilt around a port, a lot of money in ports, for the local logging industry. Before the Civil War, now this is the Liberian Civil War, the town's main exports were lumber, rubber, and agricultural goods projects. Greenville City, Liberia, according to my definition of reparations, is another form of reparations. Another form of reparations. All right, let me get off of my soapbox. Today we covered Horace King primarily. He was a bridge builder, among other things. He was part of the small percentage of people, it's 0.10%. But there's a whole lot you can do with a mustard seed. You know, the 0.10% represents thousands of people. And it's a given. Not everybody's going to jump on board. And nobody, regardless of race, color, religion, or whatever, you're never going to get 100% of everybody. But that's okay. Anyway, of all the terrific people that we've been reviewing this month, we have a few more to go. I would say Horace King has got to be my favorite so far. I mean, absolutely outstanding people. But on an individual basis, I got to go with Horace King so far. You know what? That's tough. I'm going to tie him with Fred McWhorter. Frank McWhorter. Frank McWhorter, not Fred. Frank McWhorter, who founded the first black township here in the United States. You can't compare them because they just did two utterly fantastic things. But in any event, let's go to the phone lines here. Area code 410. Your mic is wide open.
Good morning, L.A., and I'm very impressed with your black history facts all during this month. And
I wanted to cover it from – I wanted to get away from the traditional Booker T. Washington, Harriet Tubman, George Washington, and C.J. Walker. I wanted to get away from those usual people. And get into, because there are many others that did great things. So, and I wanted to break it down to entrepreneurs, people who started towns, and in some cases started nations. So,
you're doing a very good job. And, when I was in school, the teacher said there's a difference between calling words and reading.
Mm-hmm.
And she meant, hey, look, you can call words perfectly, and you can read all you want through those pages, but reading means that you can get in and really analyze what was going on in an author's mind or the real purpose of why things were written. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Some people can read.
I do agree.
Yeah, some people read it. And they don't get the full gist of what the author or the people that prepared those statements were really thinking or saying, or the message they were trying to get across.
I agree.
And I think that to say this, you know, this critical race theory thing, we black folks are complete fools. You know, what you're given is really what we should be teaching our children. And the only way we can teach our children is to have our own separate way of educating our people. And the thing is, all of this information, valuable information that you are given, has been excluded from the school system for one purpose, and that's to keep your mind enslaved. Now, you may not agree with that, but the thing is, if a child was able to look at what Horace King, is that his name?
Yeah, Horace King.
If a child could look at what Horace King did, that would inspire him or her to go in and try to reach greater heights with their lifestyle.
I feel 10 feet tall just by reading this stuff off of Wikipedia. That's just my job.
Exactly. And the thing is, we, and I'm going to say we, including you and me, you know what? We're absolute idiots because we know what it takes to train our children to perform the right way and to be exceptional. But what we'll do is we'll sit here and we'll criticize those kids and not make the investment to go in and make sure that we put up a school system to make them feel like you feel as an adult, 10 feet tall.
Right.
And what happens is they're subjected to, and what they're doing is we're really creating an environment for them to fail. And that's on you and me and the rest of us.
Matter of fact, the plug, chime in on what you're saying, and I might do a whole show on this tomorrow, figures of the past along with contemporary figures. I'm a do a little spoiler alert now. I just found about this guy like yesterday. His name is Robert Sandifer. That's spelled S-A-N-D-I-F-E-R. Some of you might have heard of him. His nickname was Yummy. Heard of him? That's right. I sent you a clip, a link of him yesterday. Let me read a little bit about it because I want to talk about his life and the stuff from the past, you know, because you're right. Robert Yummy Sandifer, born March 12th, 1983. He died on September 1st, 1994. He was an 11-year-old boy from Chicago, Illinois. His murder by fellow gang members in Chicago garnered national attention because of his age, resulting in his appearance on the cover of Time magazine. And I'm going to see if I can get a panel in here for tomorrow as well to discuss this. But to think, what had he been exposed to a Horace King? Because or any number of people. But he was killed by a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old. But we're going to cover him tomorrow and try to do a rate. How can we prevent another Yummy from dying by studying people like Horace King? I yield the mic back to you, Beasley.
LA, you don't even have to study Horace King. You don't even have to go back that far. You can start with, I read that thing on Yummy. He was in Chicago, right?
In Chicago, you're right.
During the time that that young man was born to the time that he was going through his life was the same time that Marva Collins was operating her school, wasn't it?
You know what? You're absolutely right.
Now, think about this. Now, you got millionaires upon millionaires that during that time in Chicago and around the country. Now, I was a young boy when I saw that Marva Collins clip on 60 Minutes.
Me, I was in college, I think. I was in high school. I graduated high school 76.
Okay, Marva Collins was operating her school what year?
Oh, man.
During the 70s or 80s, I guess.
Yeah, 70. Back in the 70s.
Well, it might have been 80s. I don't know. But let me give you this, Brother L.A.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get a bunch of black conservatives. And you know what? You know how I feel about black conservatives. You know, they're just a bunch of damn sellouts. Mm-hmm. And black liberals, which I feel is just a bunch of black sellouts, that's eating from the, just collecting crumbs from the master's table. Back then, we would go on with the, what do you call it, integration thing, full steam.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the vision to go in and say, Marva Collins is training people to be successful. We didn't have the vision back then to go in and say, you know what, we need to invest in this woman. If and I'm going to say this, I'm going to go out on the limb, Brother L.A., and look, I don't know if you boys out there or not. I don't give a damn. But the thing is this. We didn't have the vision to go in and say, you know what, Marvin Collins got a good thing here. And you know what, if we go in just in Chicago and support this woman with just $10 a month, we can spread her method of educating our kids to the point that we could cover one part of Southside Chicago. Didn't have to be the
you
whole city.
You know what? You're right. I'm going to call Patrick today. I don't know if I can get him in tomorrow, but we're going to put together some type of panel. We might not be able to cover it all because this is so vitally important. Go ahead. I like your train of thought on this because Yummy was right there in Chicago.
During the same time now.
Right.
During the same time Marva Collins was there. Look, you know what? You don't need a damn panel. Unless you're going to say, hey, look, you know why our kids are being destroyed because of our lack of interest in going ahead on and freeing our people's minds. You don't need no damn panel. You don't need to have no type of debate or ever what have you. Hey, look, your mama had a good thing here, and you know what? Chicago's going down the tubes into the toilet day by day. How much would it take to invest, to go in and put her structure in that city and in other cities? You know, you got Marcus Garvey Academy. You got all of these academies out here. Omar Johnson. Damn it. Look, talk is cheap. It takes money to buy land. And the thing is, all we do is intellectualize our destruction. That's all we do.
Right.
All we do is talk. And no action. And the thing is this, it's about time that we got off our ass. And I'm going to give you this. And I don't want to go in and try and be a fly in the ointment. I was looking at those statistics that you were looking at about slave populations.
Mm-hmm.
From the time, I guess I looked at it from, the 1760s all the way up to...
Yeah, I went back. I just did a quick thing this morning. I went back. I did a real quick scope. The Maryland slave population from 1850. That's what I did. And that's the earliest
okay.
I went back.
Okay, let me give you this, Ellen. You know, because you know, all we do is read words. We don't have no type of analytical bone in our damn body. And all we do is argue against one another. And, you know, I've done some of this on this show. I'm going to read you something. Well, you may not have time, but I'm going to give it to you anyway.
No, we got time. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to read the slave population of 1860. And I'm going to start with Missouri. 9.7. There was 104 slaves. There was 114,000 slaves, 9.7% of the population. Kentucky, 225,000 plus, 19.5%. Tennessee, 275 plus, 24% of the population. Now, here's where it gets gritty. Georgia, 462,198,000, or 44% of the population. North Carolina, 33% of the population. Alabama, 45% of the population. Mississippi, 55% of the population. Louisiana, 47% of the population. South Carolina, 57% of the population. Texas, 30% of the population. Arkansas, 25% of the population. Florida, 44% of the population. That was the deep south. Now, Emily, just on the top of your head, what is that telling you? What does tell you just off the top of your head? If you add
a significant number of people.
Not only that, go a bit further, LA. Go a bit further.
Which was a labor force and people were making money.
No, you didn't have a labor force of people. Well, yeah, you can say that for white folk. But now, look, did I say Virginia had a 31% population?
You just already said that's significant.
It was 491,000 black people in that state. But now, if you really think outside the box now. Abraham Lincoln said, hey, look, if I have my choice, I would not free the slaves, but I'm doing this to save the Union. Now, had the Civil War not come into effect with those kind of numbers in the South and those dumb crackers down there still increasing the slave population, or if they hadn't stopped it in the 1800s, what do you think would have happened to this Union? Just off the top of your head, then.
If they hadn't outlawed it,
black folks would have taken over this country. You already had slave insurrections all over the place.
True.
But when you have 55% of the black population in Mississippi that were black, there was no interruption in slaves reproducing themselves.
No.
They wouldn't have been able to save this Union. Can you agree with that? Can you take your head?
Well, yeah, I do agree. I can see where you're going with that. Yeah, I agree.
Now, let's go with what you're saying. You had these Back to Africa movements. Part of them was financed by white folks. In fact, I read the history of it. One of George Washington's grandsons or something was in on this thing. With this Back to Africa.
You also are correct with that. A number of white people did bankroll in part, and maybe some significant parts, did bankroll Kentucky in Africa, Mississippi in Africa. They did finance, not all of it, but quite a bit of it.
Okay. Now, let's go a bit further. When you have 55% of the black population in 1860, and look, that I'm just giving you 1860, but if you go back to 1845 and 1850, out of that 55%, you had a significant number of free blacks walking around there.
You did.
You had the Underground Railroad going through there.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, that Back to Africa movement, they were saying, look, we got too many of these free blacks around here, and look, they could be getting in the ear of our slaves. We need to ship some of these guys out of here. Now, I'm just speculating. Now,
you know what? Well, no, that, I would think that is a logical, I would think that. I'll be honest, but I would think that way.
That was their purpose. And the thing is, don't get me wrong. I'm going to give you something. You say, well, you know, those people went back to Africa and they bought land and everything. And I'm going to give you this. During the same period, they were bringing white immigrants over here under the Homestead Act and giving them thousands and thousands of acres of land at that time. But now black folks weren't. So now the thing is, if those 300 people that went back to Mississippi, Africa, why come they didn't say, well, look, we're going to give you your own stake here in America? And those black folks, if they had had a chance to participate in that Homestead Act, in fact, Brooklyn, Illinois, those people was only able to buy so much of acreage. I forgot how many acres you said it was.
I think he bought about 80 acres.
They were only able to get 80 acres of their own money when they were giving those white folks 160 acres a clip for a dollar. So what I'm trying to get across to you, Elliot, there was a lot of moving parts during that time. And
quite
you
a
had
few.
A few people. You had a lot of people like Horace King that was able to maneuver through the system to get that. But all I'm telling you is that, hey, it's a very complex story.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's a lot there. You're right. There's a lot of moving parts. You're right. There are quite a bit of moving parts, and I find this information piecemeal, and I'm basically I'm presenting it piecemeal.
Well, what you're doing is you're knitting a very, very enlightening story, but we can't dismiss the part that a large number of our people were not able to exercise in capitalism at that time because capitalism depended on us staying in the field there, on the slavery to do ever what we needed to do. Some people was able to maneuver through the system. That's just like you and me.
Right.
Would you be willing to go to Africa now?
You know, I hopefully I can get there by the end of this year. But
no, would you willing to go ahead on and as a group, put your money together and buy a bunch of land and live there from here on out?
I really could. You know what? I would have to say I haven't been there yet.
No. Regardless of that, those people hadn't been there either. I'm just saying.
That's true.
If I got together
because I over here I haven't found my little niche over here. So.
Thank you. That's the answer I wanted because you said, you know, a whole bunch of people didn't go. Well,
right.
Most
of them didn't go.
That's right. And the reason why they didn't go is because, look, we built this damn place. Regardless of what your buddy over there says, we built this damn place. And they were saying, hey, look, if I built this place, I want to enjoy some of the fruits of my labor. I ain't
well,
going.
That's true because you did have quite a number of black folk back then that bought. I mean, just on my mother's side of the family, and it's still in the family, nobody's doing nothing with it, though. There's 88 acres of land in Turvern, you know. So there are families that have 100, 200, maybe 300 acres of land today. And
right,
that would got great-grandpa. And you're right. With the kind of sweat equity, vested interest, they put the majority of them that had some significant wealth, you're right. I'm not going nowhere. I'm good, and I worked hard for this, what I got right here. So I'm going to keep it.
Brother L.A., I'm not even rich. And I ain't going because, look, I got a vested interest in this place. Now,
right.
you can feel a little all you want to. Look, in fact, I'm like this year. I'm like the white boy. I can stay here and invest over there and do whatever I need to do. But now what I'm trying to get across to you is that all during this time that all of these folks was going back to Africa and during the time we were in slavery and during the time the free black folk were able to put their money together to do things like Brooklyn, Illinois. This United States was giving away millions and millions of acres of property to people that had never had a hand in doing any damn thing to improve this country. And the key thing is this, everything we've ever done as black folks, we pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, a la Horace King, a la Horace Greeley, and all of the rest of the people that you have highlighted during this month. And I wanted to just put that out there to let people know these were exceptions and not the norm. So that's right. Just like today, Oprah Winfrey is the exception, not the norm. Bill Cosby is the 100 years from now, somebody like you might say, well, you know what? Black folks didn't have an excuse back then. Because Bill Cosby was able to make it. Oprah Winfrey made it. What's his name? Johnson of BET made it. whereas the vast majority of us is fighting through this system of racism. And the thing is, the reason why we are losing is because people like you and I and the boy over there in St. Louis, we can't get together and say, you know what, we need to come in here as a group and do what we need to do. And like Marva Collins, I go back to Yummy. Those people, see, Brother L.A., we the biggest fools on the planet. Those people had an opportunity to finance Marva Collins and educate their kids to be successful. They may not have gotten $1 million, but the thing is, they would have been productive human beings in this system of racism. And I told you what racism is. Racism is just a pseudonym, a one-word pseudonym for self-preservation and survival of the fittest. And you can't be a successful people if you don't have an identity. And what happened is they have beat us, and like you say, Horace Greeley to beat one of those guys that was a slave for him, and they were black.
Yeah, he did. Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, we didn't realize, hey, look, you know what? If one of us are enslaved, all of us are enslaved. And my safety and my well-being depends on numbers. And in order for us to have numbers, we better try and figure out a way to get these people out of the fields and put something in their hands to try and get out from under this oppressive system. And it never happened, and it never will. And the thing is, all you got to look at us today, we see people getting shot down in the street. We see people taking away our voting rights. We see people dismantling the civil rights victories we made in the 60s that have made it possible for us to enjoy some semblance of liberty. And the thing is, we're sitting here arguing as capitalists, socialists, communists, and we're arguing as conservatives, liberals, and independents. And we're separating ourselves by education and money. And the thing is, we're going right back into slavery because you said it best. See, LeBron James can be traded.
Right.
Didn't they trade people in slavery?
Those artisans traded all the time.
Yeah. And those artisans back then, a slave master will say, well, look, you know, I owe you money. Like, I got old Jim here that does blacksmithing. I'll give him to you if you give me Nellie that I need in the house to cook. So we're still on the plantation. Still in the plantation, brother. And the thing is, you can have all the money you want. You can be as connected in the political scheme as you want to as a Republican, conservative, or a Democratic liberal. You're just a damn slave with no damn sense. Because the thing is, we could overcome this if we would organize ourselves as an identity, organize our money to do what the hell we need to do in the communities we's in. And look, when you organize yourself as a group, see, everybody is going to, some people are just going to be more successful than others.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, the only way we could, if we were organized as a group, they'd be more Oprah-referees. They'd be more Bill Cosby's. But the thing is, we have bought into this bullshit that, hey, I'm different because I have a little bit more money, or I can talk to Newt Gingrich whenever I want to. I can sit at his table and talk to him and just like I'm one of the family, or either I can go to Nancy Pelosi's house and have a nice drink of wine. And the thing is, they're slowly performing genocide on us through the Planned Parenthood neighborhood. And they're slowly taking away whatever little bit of rice you got. And we're just like a frog in a pot of water. You heat it slowly until you get them all out, till you get all of these damn foreigners in here, Mexicans. And the thing is, after they get our numbers down like they want to, then they'll deal with the rest of us like they did them Jews in Germany. But this year is a very exciting month that you put together. And it shows that we can do and have done, and we're still doing, and we ain't waiting for no damn check. Now, the thing is, I'm preaching reparations because I want our children to know, hey, like the Jews say, never again. This thing can happen again. But the thing is, I want that conversation out there because I don't want no cracker to rest in peace saying that, you need to get over that. You know, you already got your reparations. Because, look, Brother L.A., you and I got our reparations. We can go back to Africa tomorrow, but we ain't going. Now, since you want to put it that way.
Not to live.
Huh? Oh, see, that's what I'm saying. But you got your reparations, according to you.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you can go.
According to my definition, I got my reparations,
Yeah, and I got mine according to your definitions. But the thing is, that conversations need to be had because, see, we're very complacent people. Because, see, we ain't getting the information you're giving, and we think that everybody was hunky-dory during slavery. Everybody was getting paid during slavery. And in actuality, it was one of the most brutal systems that's ever been implemented on this planet, bar none. Now, you can say the Jews was going through their bullshit if you want to, but nobody has been through the shit that we've been through. And then you want to tell us to forget it, like your boy Mandela. Forget the past. No, we ain't forgetting shit. That's why come that reparation conversation is so important. Now, I get off and let your boy come on in here and let him talk.
Well, we're going to wrap it up for today because it's 12:40 now. But tomorrow, what we're going to do, we're going to build, I don't know how I'm going to spin it for a title, but one of the central figures we're going to talk about tomorrow, and we want to tie him into Black History Month. Hold on, hang one up. We'll be talking about Yummy, but 314, your mic is open.
You know you've been off the air for the last 20 minutes. You see that email I sent you?
No, because I've been looking at another board. Oh, hold on, I'm looking at it now.
I'm glad you was out there. Everybody didn't get to hear all that.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking at their bill. I'm looking at it right now. Open it up.
What is it?
It is a picture of a beautifully designed courthouse.
Well, it ain't designed. It was built.
Well, and built.
Yes. Wonder who built that? How many stories that look like to you?
It's a lot of them. There's a lot of stories of this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Wonder who built that?
What, about 14 stories?
No, it's more than this, I think. I don't remember. You know how to do something.
It's a lot of stories. It's at least 14.
You just can't keep up with this stuff. You know, the kids, and I worked with some a school in St. Louis. Georgia. We used to organize field trips. And one thing I did not do was teach no Black history subjects.
Okay.
You know why?
Was it?
Because we got Black people already here today doing things. I mean, you get me? Like you say, this guy here built bridges.
Yeah, Horace King.
So,
Horace King, that's his name.
Yeah, Horace King. You say he built bridges. Where are they?
Well, I named some of the places down in Phoenix City, Alabama, Columbus, Georgia. I named the places.
Yeah, but they not there, are they?
I imagine some are, and some might not be.
What year was this that was going on?
Let's see. Yeah. Hurricane, what year? 1830s and 40s.
Well, see, here's the thing. That's the difference with people that know how to think logically. And I ain't saying you, but other idiots.
They wasn't dealing with no steel in those days, and he surely wasn't. They was just putting boards across a hole. Think. Just think. It just laying boards down across a hole, or probably across a stream. It wasn't no structural bridges. It wasn't no box bridges. It surely the heck wasn't no suspension.
But
do you understand what I'm saying?
Don't we have to factor in the because some of those bridges were like city contracts, but don't we have to figure in? I mean, factor in the technology of the time. Okay.
No. Because when I'm in the classroom teaching modern math or showing children how to use applied math, you know how I do to stimulate their mind? Like I did at Lucas and Hunt Crossing there on Natural Bridge Road. Get it right now. Mm. Lucas and Hunt Crossing. It ain't the only one. I took them out to my job site and showed them how the math is used to put up this building. Now, what math is used, especially complicated math, exponents, trigonometry, is used with laying boards across a hole. Think. All that other stuff sounds good. Ooh-wee, they did. No, that ain't nothing but a bunch of rotors. Let me take the kids back and back to 1800s and 1700s and show them how some of what you got blacks that's doing it today. That's the history. And when I show somebody, and you all this month, you're going to have Black History Talk. You're not going to mention me. Did you get the one I sent on Ondo State? The seaport?
$4, 5, or $6 billion seaport I designed.
What did that look like? Open it up. And see, there's a lot of things I could show you, but I don't want people begging you for it so they can get some ideas. Because people like,
well,
especially
you know, Negroes. With the port thing, I would like to do not only a podcast, but it's got to be visual. Because when you sent me the picture of that port, the seaport, is I was thinking about the TV show The Wire, because that conversation of sports and entertainment, we need, in my opinion, we need to have conversations of, you know, building ports, how much money it comes through a port.
Well,
you know?
Eric, I hear what you say, but you can't.
Right.
You cannot talk to somebody who can't even ram what you're talking about. It's only certain people can do those things. That's just a waste of time. I tell you the truth, it's a waste of time.
But I think people that does that
don't have time to be wasting time.
Well, you know what? I'm gonna say that question.
I mean,
tomorrow.
Think about it. You've been having discussion about tiny homes for how long? How many of the people that you list that's listening to, especially one, has built a tiny home?
I know of one right now. She's restoring one.
There you go. How many of you know you've been talking about grocery store? I even brought a grocery store mongrel. You remember the one I had on here?
Yeah, he's a grocery store mongo.
They offer him $10 million to build one down in Cairo, Illinois.
Well, the thing is, we already know that the majority of people, even if they were white folks, the majority of people are happy with a 9-to-5.
And don't mention white folks. We're talking about Black History Month, right?
Yeah. My theory is this. Put out the information and maybe somebody, and it might be somebody I'll never even know they existed, somebody might say, you know what? let me go to engineering school.
And well, you know what
somebody,
else, too?
Yeah.
People keep saying slaves built the United States. Ain't no slaves built the United States. If they did, show me where. Where's the bridge? They might have been working on it. And you remember I told you that if this word slave don't mean exactly what it means. You know, here's the thing I keep telling you. Africa had civilized people, right?
Mm-hmm.
People ain't going to get rid of stuff that's of some good to them. Think about that. People will not get rid of stuff that is of some use to them. Think. If you came home, somebody was stealing out of your house, which one would you be more concerned of? A stack of newspaper or your microwave?
The microwave.
Think. You going to let them go with the stack of newspapers because
yeah,
they ain't no good to you.
Mm-hmm.
I keep telling you, that building, and of course the port is in another country. And that ain't the only project. I could not design that, lay out the specifications for that, and other necessary things, if what, L.A.? If I hadn't done it already. That's one of the reasons they come to me. I say, no, I've been successful. And I ain't bragging about it because some things I don't even want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I won't do it. I ain't working with no liberal blacks. You know why? Because they vote against your interest.
That's a whole nother podcast.
I ain't working with them because they vote against your interest. They the type that would turn around and stab you in the back after they get done eating and wiping their fish mouth, greasy lips. They'll turn around and stab you in the back. And I'm for one only give them one time to do that. And I ain't have a damn thing to do with them the rest of my life. And that's what I tell others, too. That's one of the problems. You try to carry on too much useless baggage. That can't do jack. All they want to do is, hey, come on, they want other people to contribute. And they mooch off of, steal off of, and they don't do a damn thing. Hey, I'll let you go ahead and close your show out.
All right, thanks for the feedback, Pianki. Thank you, Beezy. Thank you, everybody else. Tomorrow we're going to be tying in to Black History. Yummy.